This morning, we launched our fourth campus at the Summit Church over on West Club Boulevard. For those of you that are joining us via our West Club campus, welcome to you guys, and also at Coal Mill Road and at Briar Creek. We are now a church that meets in four different campuses, two at Briar Creek, one on Sunday morning, one on Sunday night, and one at West Club Boulevard in downtown Durham, and of course also at Coal Mill Road. So wherever you are joining us this morning, welcome definitely to you. Science has disproved the Bible. At least that's what sometimes people struggle with. This is objection is one that I am sure that you have encountered at some point, especially if you are in college or if you have recently been in college. You were in some class, and some science class, maybe a history class, maybe a psychology class, and the professor has proven that what the Bible says is actually wrong. And at that point, you don't really know what to do because you respect your professor, or he or she certainly sounds like they know what they're talking about, and certainly they know more than you do. And so you end up wondering, is science and the historical, you know, arts and those kind of things, are those the enemy of Christianity? Guys like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, their books, God Delusion, God Is Not Great, certainly make you think that science and intelligent academics are the enemies of Christianity. I've had several people ask me over the years, as they were considering Christianity, they will say to me, but what about evolution? You know, because they think that to become a Christian, you have to turn your back on this mountain of data they believe that supports evolution. This objection was also one of the most common that we got on our website, the www.whyimnotachristian.com. It was one of the most frequently recurring ones. In fact, I quote from someone on that website. They said, basically, I feel that religion outgrew its usefulness when science became as accurate as it is today, as do many others my age. I'll never believe anything that I can't see or won't see. I'll never have true faith in anything. So today, I want to talk to you about what you are supposed to do, biblically speaking, when you have a question about science and the Bible. And for those of you that this is your question, this is your hang-up with Christianity, I want to tell you what the Bible, what Jesus, what he says to us about this. You know, really the things that we're going to discuss today really in some ways encapsulate this entire series. Because all seven of these objections that we have worked through, and we're on number six, we have one more to go, are basically kinds of doubts that people have. And so we're going to discuss today principles and how you are to handle them. You know, I told you that for many years, and even sometimes now, I have had doubts. In fact, as I have said before, I believe that in reality there are only three kinds of Christians. There are those who are currently struggling with doubt, those who have at some point in their past struggled with doubt, and those that don't think. Okay, so if you are saying, well, I've never struggled with doubt, don't tell anybody that, okay, because it just tells us that you're not really a thinking person. And I've told you that if you really think about it, doubt is a good thing, or can be a good thing, because it is like a foot that is poised, to take a step. Yes, doubt can drive you backwards into unbelief, but doubt also can drive you forwards to go deeper with God. I've compared it to like a vaccine that you get. You know, faith that never doubts is like a body without antibodies. It is when that you develop the antibodies that you're able to resist deeper diseases. If you're listening to me, perhaps you can tell that I'm not that good at developing antibodies. I got sick last week and thought that, you know, when you get a cold, you're supposed to have, like, after you get over it, like about 7 or 8, like, free days, you know, where you're not susceptible to other sickness, at least what I've always heard. So my kids had a cold this week at the end of the week, and I thought, you know, I'm totally immune. It's okay. So I wasn't careful, and now I've gotten their cold. I'm like just a magnet for all these things. So don't come talk to me after the service because I'm sick and I'm in a bad mood. I believe that God can handle our doubts. That's what I want to say. I believe God can handle our doubts. In fact, I would say there's a greater danger in having a superficial, untested faith than there is with struggling with doubt. So today we get to turn to one of the most famous doubters of all, ever in history. You know him. His name is Thomas. I've noticed that I've never met anybody who doesn't like Thomas. Everybody thinks that there's something about themselves that is in Thomas, And I think we feel some sympathy with him. So today, we're going to take a look at his story. It's pretty fascinating. It's in John chapter 20. We're going to read beginning in verse number 28. And we're going to read all the way down through verse 29 and then pick up verses 30 and 31 toward the end. Okay? So verse 24 is where we begin. You have your Bible. You may want to open it there. If not, then as usual, it will be on the screen here. Now Thomas, who was one of the 12 disciples, of course, also called the twin. In Greek, by the way, that is Didymus, from which we get our word ditto. That was his nickname. His nickname was Ditto. He was an identical monozygotic twin with Matthew, the tax collector, is what scholars tell us. So he was the twin brother of a tax collector. No wonder he was always depressed. All right? He was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he, Thomas, said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails, and place my finger into the mark of the nails, and place my hand into his side," which sounds a little gross to me, "I will never believe." Okay, that's his bold statement to the disciples. But guess who else is listening to this conversation that he doesn't realize? Jesus is listening to this conversation, and he's like, "All right, trash talker, we'll follow up on this." Verse 26, 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them, and he said to them, "Peace be with you." Verse 27, then he said to Thomas, "Now put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, Thomas, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Verse 29, Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Well, blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Thomas here in this story confronts something that seems very improbable to him, and that is the news of Christ's resurrection. You see, that news does not fit his worldview because in Thomas's worldview, messiahs don't suffer humiliating deaths at the hands of Romans, and dead men don't rise from the dead, right? And as such, the news about Christ's resurrection is simply unbelievable to him. And so, when he hears it, he doubts it, right? And so the first thing I want you to realize is that doubt is nothing new. Sometimes I think people in our day and age were arrogant enough to believe that doubt is something new for us in our new elevations of knowledge that we have ascended to. You know, everybody back in the old days, they were gullible mental midgets who, of course, believed whatever wild tale that you told them. You know, the juju monster at the bottom of the sea? Sure. You know, Christ risen from the dead? Yeah, who would doubt that? You know, and we think today we're just starting to come of age. Now people know better than to believe fairy tales. Well, I mean, this shows you that's not true. Christianity has always exploded people's worldview. And even back then, some of Jesus' closest disciples struggle with doubt. Right? So the question is, what do you do when you doubt? Here's a principle I want to teach you, and I'm going to borrow a phrase from Tim Keller, whose book that many of our small groups have been reading along with this series, A Reason for God, or The Reason for God. And the principle is this, all right? You may want to jot this down. Learn to doubt your doubts. Learn to doubt your doubts. Let me try to explain what that means. You see, every doubt, all right, think about this for a minute, all right? You're going to have to think with me here for the next 6 or 7 minutes kind of deeply, so get ready. Every doubt comes because you have faith in something else. You see, Thomas doubts that Jesus could rise from the dead because he believes in his worldview. He has faith in his worldview, which says that in the real world, people don't rise from the dead. So he won't believe that Jesus rose from the dead, or he doubts that because he's never seen somebody rise from the dead. But is that a correct assumption about the universe or about the world? Well, according to this story, no. You see, so the message of this story is that Thomas should doubt his worldview when he encounters evidence that won't fit into it. You see, you should be willing to doubt your doubts in the face of compelling evidence. Or you should doubt the faith commitment that causes you to have those doubts, or at least be willing to do so. Does that make sense to you? I didn't think so. Okay, so let me keep going on this. The reason I say this is because people who doubt the reality of Jesus' resurrection often say they only will believe what they can see with their eyes. They won't accept miracles because miracles cannot be tested or replicated. But is that wise to say that simply because you've never seen a miracle that they never happen? Well, it is a faith commitment of your on your part to say that all truth in the universe can be discovered by science. You see, the doubts you have about miracles come from a confidence in or faith in the power of science to uncover all truth. You see, people say to me, as they did on that website, I don't have faith. I believe in science and the power of reason. That is faith also. You have faith that men and women using science and reason can accurately deduce all there is to know about truth. That is exactly what Richard Dawkins says in The God Delusion in just about those exact words. He says he will not believe anything that science cannot prove because ultimately science is the way that we will uncover all truth. All right? But see, that is a faith commitment also. Is it reasonable to assume that all the truth that there is in the world can fit underneath a microscope? And is it reasonable to assume that just because you've never seen a miracle that they don't happen? Is it reasonable for Thomas to insist that just because he's never seen a man raised from the dead, that it never happens? Well, in this case, obviously not. And if you refuse to doubt your doubts when evidence surfaces that really ought to make you question your doubts or question the faith commitment that gives rise to those doubts, it might cause you to miss some really obvious points. All right, let me illustrate this from a completely different angle. Let's say that where you work, you were on a team that was working together on a project, right? And so part of this project is you have a joint business account that you all draw from, and it is discovered that someone is embezzling money from this account, and it's obvious it's got to be one of your team members. So your boss comes to you and says, I need you to figure out who is embezzling money from this account on your team, right? So you look at your team. There's 8 people on it. Five of them are Republicans. 3 of them are Democrats. You yourself are a diehard Republican. So you look at your team and say, well, I'm only going to investigate the 3 Democrats because everybody knows that Republicans don't ever embezzle money, okay? And that is what you believe because you yourself are a Republican. Now, would that be wise? No, that would be foolish. It would be bigoted and an unwise confidence in all Republicans. Hello, Jack Abramoff, okay? All right? It would be a confidence that is not warranted and a false confidence that would keep you from entertaining all possible evidence. What you should be open to is doubting the confidence that you have in all Republicans and be open to all the evidence, whether it points to your preconceived faith or not. Does that make sense now? Say yes, because I don't have any more time on this. In Thomas's case, seeing the resurrection of Jesus is what destroys his assumption that miracles don't happen. Now, some of you are like at this point, well, duh, I know. I mean, if only Jesus would do that to me, if he would appear like, you know, on the foot of my bed tonight and say, do not be unbelieving, but believe, feel the nails in my hands and put your hand on my side, I would never doubt again. All right? And I understand that. So watch this, verse 31. These things are written, Jesus said, so that you, or actually John says, these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. You see, there are some things that the Bible leaves us that point to the fact that science cannot answer all of our questions and that Jesus' message really was true. I'm going to give you in the next few minutes, you ready for this? 9 things that the Bible says that point us to the reality of a God that is behind and outside of science. Because I'm going to cover 9 things, undoubtedly some of these you're not going to understand. So I would encourage you to go to our website, get the transcript, follow down all the sources that I put in there meticulously, and you spend as much time on these as is, because these are the 9 things that I believe the Bible most prominently points to as showing you that there's something beyond just what you see with your eyes, okay? Here is 1, the fact that materialism does not satisfy. The fact that materialism, and by materialism, I don't just mean, you know, collecting a lot of money. I mean anything in the world. That's the materials of the world. The fact that nothing on the earth really satisfies us, right? And you find that the older that you grow. You know, famous example, John D. Rockefeller, arguably the richest man in history, right? For all practical purposes, his money was virtually limitless. Once, toward the end of his life, an interviewer asked him, how much money is enough? And Rockefeller replied, just a little bit more, right? Because he's saying, I've gotten everything. I get everything you could ever want. I've got it. And it's not satisfying to me. You see, what the Bible says, as Blaise Pascal, the French philosopher in the 18th century, explained, every one of us is created by God with a God-shaped vacuum in our heart. And that is why nothing on the world, not money, not success, not even family, and not even romance or sex ends up satisfying our souls ultimately, because we are created to know God, and only when we know God will we be satisfied. St. Augustine, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. C.S. Lewis says it this way: our dissatisfaction with time argues for the fact that we were created for eternity. Do fish complain of the sea for being wet? Or if they did, would that not strongly suggest that they had not been or were not destined to be aquatic creatures? We long to step out of the sea of time onto the sand of eternity. So then, Lewis says, if I find in myself a desire which nothing in this world can satisfy, the best argument is I was created for another world. You see, the fact that we hunger for something this world can't satisfy is a strong indication that we were created for another world. Our dissatisfaction with this world is a clue that we were created for another one. Okay, or at least we were destined for another one. Here is number two. Number two, the problem of human rights in an accidental universe. All right, let me explain that one to you for a minute. This is one I always get people riled up about, and they email me, and so I'm going to try to do a better job with this one. Because if you email me, I'm not going to read it. No, I'm just kidding. Most people believe that there are basic human rights, right? I mean, most people believe that. Things like murder, oppression, sexual assault, these things we believe are wrong in every time and culture, right? We don't hear about the abuse of women and children or the genocide of an entire race of people in the Sudan and say, well, that's just how things are over there. They're different than we are. No, we look at those things and we say that oppression is wrong. The only way that we can say something is unjust, however, is if we appeal to a higher vision of how things ought to be. Martin Luther King, for example, said the only way that we could know that a current law is unjust is because it conflicts with a higher law. And so he said in the 60s that current racist laws in America were unjust, even though a majority of Americans supported them, because, he says, they violate the higher law of God. So when we look at oppression and we say that's wrong, we say that's wrong because how it is not how it is supposed to be like that. You see, the only way we can say that there is a universal human right is if we have an understanding of how things ought to be, a higher law than simply this is how things are, that points to a reality that is higher than science, or in other words, a God. You see, I mean, even if evolution could tell you how we got here, it could make no statement about how things ought to be now that we're here. You could never complain about violence and injustice and say, it shouldn't be like that. In fact, according to the laws of evolution, the only reason our species is here is because they violently beat out all the other species. That is survival of the fittest. And it's just how things are in the universe. And so you can't complain about it. It's just what they are. Right? We know something in that doesn't work. It doesn't jive with us. Which is why C.S. Lewis explained that ultimately, this is what brought him to see that there had to be a God. You see, at first, Lewis could not understand how there could be a good God with all the injustice in the universe. In the end, however, he realized that injustice was more of a problem for him as an atheist. He says, and I quote, "My argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But where had I gotten this idea of just and unjust? What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust?" Let me paraphrase the next part here in Mere Christianity. He said, if the evolutionary process was solely responsible for life, it meant that there was no such thing as universal justice, only things that were personally beneficial for me. All right? And then he says, and I quote again, "But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too. For the argument depended on saying that my world was really unjust, not simply that it did not happen to please my private fancies. Consequently," he said, "atheism turned out to be too simple." Right? The fact that there are, we understand, universal human rights is an indication that there's something beyond just science in the world, right? Because science doesn't point to how it ought to be. It just points to how it is. Here's number three, the power of love and beauty. The power of love and beauty in our lives. You see, if atheistic evolution is true, then love is just a chemical reaction in the brain. Now, that doesn't make for a very good Hallmark card, does it? Right? The love that I feel for you is just a random assortment of chemicals that I inherited. And my desire to be with you is really this just the desire of those chemicals wanting to propagate their genetic distinctives into future generations. Right? Survival of the fittest, baby. Will you be my Valentine? I mean, it doesn't work, does it? And when people actually do follow this out, it's pretty grotesque. I mean, you remember I've quoted the song to you before by the Bloodhound Gang. You and me, baby, ain't nothing but mammals. So let's do it like they do on the Discovery Channel. Right? I mean, it's just grotesque. There's something offensive in that. I mean, no offense, but true evolutionists make pretty crappy romancers. All right? And sorry for using the word crap. It's the only word I can think of to describe it. If atheistic evolution is true, I thought of another one, but I definitely didn't want to use that one. If atheistic evolution is true, then the experience of beauty is an illusion. And so is the desire for love and meaning. You know, I read one philosopher who said, death awaits us all like a concrete floor awaits a dropping light bulb. In the real world, he says, the frog remains a frog. Cinderella never makes it to the ball, and beauty never wakes up. Right? I mean, Nietzsche, Sartre, philosophers that were brave enough to follow their thoughts to their logical conclusion, they tell us that when we die, that's it. Our existence is over, and all that awaits us is to be eaten by worms. Does that satisfy you? For most of you, no. You know that there has to be justice, has to be beauty. You see, Ecclesiastes says it like this: God put those things in your heart. He put eternity in your heart as an echo of a future world. Right, or an echo of the real world. There are moments when you look up into the sky and you get a sense that there's something bigger, some meaning to life beyond the grave, something beyond just being eaten by worms when you die and your body rots. Right, here's number four. The persistence of Christianity throughout the centuries. Right, now some of you, if you object with me on some of this stuff, this one will really throw you for a loop, but hear me out. All right, in a recent poll, 2/3 of Britons said that they thought Christianity would be dead within 100 years. Right? Does that depress you? It shouldn't. Maybe for Britain it does. But this wouldn't be the first time that such predictions have been made. Voltaire said, you know, almost 300 years ago, I think, Voltaire predicted that Christianity would be extinct within 100 years of his death. That was in 1778. Okay, so 200 and some years ago. In a sweet bit of irony, All right. At year 100, his estate had been transformed into a Bible printing press. And last we checked, it's still going strong. Right? John Lennon said in 1966, he said that the Beatles, right, within his lifetime would be more popular than Jesus. Right? Now, I think John Lennon and his music were great, right? But we're not sitting here this morning listening to John Lennon music. Despite such predictions, Christianity keeps on going under all circumstances, to the chagrin of guys like Dawkins and Hitchens and Stephen Hawking. Growth in science and technology have not led to a reduced belief in God, right? I mean, this Christianity, we're like the Energizer Bunny. You know, the worldwide church right now, I don't know if you realize this, is larger than the population of China. The worldwide church is larger in population than the entire country of India. The population of the church is larger than China and India combined. And today, this morning, more people in our country in one morning will sit in a church learning and hearing about God than will attend a professional sports game. If you combine all professional sports all throughout the year, that number would not equal the number of people that are sitting in a church this morning hearing about God. The church is the most global organization on earth. It is growing fastest in non-Western places, and it shows no sign of slowing. Okay? So that is a strong indication. Here is number five, the question of the origin of the universe. Even if you believe in a Big Bang and that everything happened from evolution, you still have the question of where it all came from in the first place. No scientist believes that spontaneous generation created all there is in the universe. Louis Pasteur proved that was not possible. Right? In other words, you can't multiply nothing times nobody and come up with everything. That dog won't hunt, as we say in Yakkaville, all right, which is not necessarily the most educated place in the world, but it's still a good phrase. Dawkins, Hawking, what's interesting is they have absolutely no answer for that, and they admit it. In The God Delusion, that book, Dawkins says, quote, Darwin's theory works for biology, but not for cosmology. And what he means by that is, I don't know how all the materials got here in the first place. But then he says this, listen to this. But don't worry, ultimately we'll figure it out. Scientists will come up with the answer. That's what you call faith, right? I don't know the answer, but we're going to do the God of the gaps here and say that ultimately science is going to figure everything out. All right, number six, the prophecies of the Old Testament. The prophecies of the Old Testament are an indication to you. The Bible writers are always doing this. They're always referring you back to the Old Testament and saying, look at these things. Now, do you know how much of your Bible is prophecy? What percentage? 25%. Okay, you were thinking it, but you didn't want to say it. 25%. There are 300 prophecies foretelling with incredible specificity the details of Jesus' life. Right? Now, you understand, these are not like the prophecies of Nostradamus, if you've ever read those. You know, someday somebody from somewhere near some ocean is going to come up and make people want to fight with each other, and I think he's got a beard and he likes to wear T-shirts. Not those kind of prophecies. Right? These are prophecies that tell with great specificity what Jesus would be like, where he would be born, Micah 5:2 in Bethlehem. Right, you know how old he would be when he died, Daniel chapter 9, that he would be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, that's Zechariah chapter 9, that he would die by crucifixion, that's Isaiah 53 or Psalm 22, that he would be resurrected from the dead, that's Isaiah 54, right, that he would be from the tribe of Judah, that's Genesis 49, okay, I mean, and 290 some others of them that tell you with great specificity what Jesus would be like. Now, I know that some people look at those prophecies and they say, lucky? That's what it was, nothing but luck. Jesus saw an opportunity. He was reading the Old Testament and thought, hey, this could be me. And he jumped in and fulfilled all these prophecies randomly. You know, I once saw a mathematician who worked this out. And he says, the odds of all the specific prophecies of the Old Testament randomly coalescing on Jesus Christ is 1 in 10 to the 157th power. But that's 10 with 157, you know, zeros and 52 commas between those zeros. That's a huge number. And the number is so big, it doesn't even make sense to us, right? I'll give you a frame of reference. 1 in 10 to the 16th power, with only 16 zeros. That would be the odds if you were to cover the entire states of North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia. If you were to cover those states in silver dollars 2 feet deep, that's a lot of silver dollars. You were to paint one of them randomly black, okay, and just throw it somewhere in the middle there, randomly. And then you were to take a blind man and catapult him from somewhere in Maryland, okay, and just shoot him randomly into all these silver dollars, the chances of him picking out the one black silver dollar is 1 in 10 to the 16th power. The chance of Jesus randomly fulfilling all these 300 prophecies, 1 in 10 to the 157th power. Not one of them was ever wrong, right? And also, it was completely unlike Nostradamus, which got many of his prophecies wrong. Now, people say this. They're like, well, what if, you know, some of the Bible writers beefed up these prophecies? You know, they're like, oh, well, let's go back into Isaiah and let's change this over here so that it sounds like Jesus. Several dozen years ago, last century, there was a discovery made of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Scholars were absolutely giddy when they discovered these Dead Sea Scrolls because they were from a cave that had not been opened since 200 years before Christ's birth. And they contained in it scrolls of the Old Testament. And scholars were sure that they were going to go back into the Old Testament and find that the Christians had doctored up all their copies of the Old Testament. And these copies of the Old Testament that predated Christ by 200 years, they would figure out that there was, you know, stuff not nearly as clear about Jesus Christ. And that what they found down to almost the word was exactly the Old Testament that you hold right there in your hands if you have a copy of it in front of you. Okay, so it wasn't beefed up. The prophecies of the Old Testament are a strong suggestion that somebody besides men wrote the Bible. Right? Number seven, the historical evidence for the resurrection. Now, I do not have time for this one, okay? Or a lot of time. So you just come back at Easter and I always deal with it then. Or just get the book by Lee Strobel, Case for Christ, and he does a good job. I'll just give you one example that's my favorite one, and if you come here, I'm sure you've heard me reference it before. One of my favorite authors now is a lady named Anne Rice. Anne Rice was a famous, she's in her late 70s now, I think. She was famous because she wrote what they called historical fiction. What she would do is she would discover some historical anomaly, like the bubonic plague or something, and she'd figure out, she'd do this meticulous research about the actual event, and then she would write this strange supernatural tale that wove through the historical facts. Scholars loved her because she was down to the money when it came to describing the facts about the time period she was writing in. But then she had this wild historical, she did all the vampire books, Interview with a Vampire. Okay, so what she did is she said that her life's work was going to be, in her 60s, writing a book on the birth of the church. She said, the greatest historical mystery to me has always been how a group of Jewish peasants and fishermen launched the greatest, religious awakening in the world. She was an agnostic. She said, I did not believe in God. And so I was going to do meticulous research and figure out what actually happened back in that day and time. Because I'm sure it wasn't what the Christian said it was. And so it's if you get her book, Christ the Lord, this is all in the postlogue of that book. It's worth the price of the whole book. It's one of the 20 most fascinating pages I've ever read. She said, as I got into discovering it, though, she said, two things happened I wasn't expecting. And she said this. She said, number one, she said, I discovered that the scholarship about Jesus Christ was the most biased scholarship that I had ever encountered. She said, it was clear that most New Testament scholars intensely disliked Jesus Christ. And they really wanted him to be like them. She said, I was expecting to find a gay Jesus, a married Jesus, a left-wing liberal Jesus. She said, but I couldn't find that. She goes, it was biased. That's all there was to it. By the way, UNC students, I wrote her and somehow got her an email, and she emailed me back directly. It was pretty. And she said, I asked her, I said, were you talking about Bart Ehrman? She said, yes. Okay. And I invited her to come out here, and she couldn't work it out because she said she was too old. All right. Because she lives in California. The second thing she said, you know, this is awesome. Yeah, this is in that postlog. She says, as I was hunting for the real Jesus, she said, it was apparent that something was hunting me. And she says, I discovered that the more I went, that I was not dealing with an historical anomaly. I was dealing with something real. And then she says, in this great little paragraph, she says, the only way the church could have been born, the only way these things could have happened, was because Jesus rose from the dead. She says, there's no other explanation for it but that. I would just invite you to go back and look and consider and delve into it deeply. All right, I don't have time to answer all these questions. I just invite you to begin the process, because I think you'll find that something begins to follow you as you begin to follow it. All right, number eight, the completely unique message of Christianity. Here's another one that I preach whole sermons on, so I don't have time to go into it. But see, people are fond of saying every religion is basically the same thing, right? They all teach the same things. You can find that about most religions. It is just not true about the gospel. Every religion in the world teaches you that if you do enough, then God will accept you, right? The message of every religion is, if you obey, then you will be accepted. Christianity stands alone in that it says, no. It's not because of what you do, it's because of what Christ has done for you. You are accepted, therefore you obey. Every religion in the world is spelled D-O. Christianity alone, the real Christianity, the gospel, is spelled D-O-N-E. Done. Right? And that is a strong indication that wherever all the other religions come from, Christianity or the gospel does not come from the same place. Here is number nine. Jesus' personal claims about himself. His personal claims about himself. People are very fond, okay, of saying, they love to say, well, Jesus, he was a great man. He was a great prophet, like Buddha, Muhammad, they're all the same. They all taught us to love God, love each other, except for Buddha, because he didn't really believe in God. But, basically the same thing, right? As C.S. Lewis points out, I'm actually not going to read his quote to you. He's like, Jesus never left you that option. He goes, you can't say that, because it means you don't even understand even what he said. He said he claimed to be God. He said no other religious leader, at least the ones you just referred to, claim that for themselves, certainly not Muhammad. He said when a man claims to be God, your options for what he is are limited, okay? Right? He says, if he's not God, and he knows he's not God, then in telling you he is God, he is a liar that is worse than any other liar in history, because he's going to cause you to put your faith in him, and he's willfully deceiving you, right? He says, so he could be a liar when Jesus claimed to be God. You're like, where did he claim to be God? John 8:58, John 10:30, and about 15 other places, okay? All right, so he could have been a liar, Lewis says, or he could have really thought he was God when he wasn't, right? I mean, being God is not the kind of thing you can just be wrong about, I might think that I'm the greatest basketball player in the Summit Church. I might be wrong about that. Probably not, but I might be wrong about that, okay? Right? But you can't just be like, wrong about being God. You know, I really thought I was God. I thought I created the whole universe, but dang it, I was totally mistaken. You know, I mean, he says if he thought he was God and he actually wasn't, he's a lunatic. His word is on the level of the man who says he's a poached egg. He said the third option is he really was God. He says, so Jesus' personal claims about himself remove the category everybody wants to put him into, and that is great religious teacher. He said he didn't leave you that option. He claimed to be God, and you got to decide who he was. Was he a liar, was he a lunatic, or was he really the Lord from heaven? Now, that's nine things. You made it. Are you proud of yourself? Good. You're like, what's that got to do with doubt? All right, these things point you to the fact that there is a God, and that that God was present in Jesus Christ, and that affects, in turn, how you look at things that you can't explain or don't understand yet. All right? Let me borrow an analogy. I've used it before, but, you know, you need to hear it again. Borrow an analogy that I borrow from Plato's Republic and then adapt a little bit because Plato wasn't a Christian. All right? Plato's Republic. I want you to imagine for a minute that in this room right here, it had no doors, no windows. It has no windows, so that's not hard to imagine, but no doors. Okay? And none of us, for all of our lives, we've always been in this room. Right? We don't know where we came from. We just know we're here. That's all we know. And each other is all we know. Nobody has ever left this room. Nobody has ever come into this room because there's no doors and no windows. It's just the four walls. Well, one day, you and I get in an argument about what's on the other side of that wall. What's on the outside of the wall of the room that we're sitting in? Okay? Well, you know, you're like, well, I think it's a room identical to this one. And then somebody else says, no, it's not. It's a room exactly the opposite of this one. It's like Bizarro World over there. Everything's backwards. Another person says, I don't think that's it at all. I think it's like, you know, full of wild animals and, you know, wild billy goats and hyenas and that kind of stuff. You know, and so, and all the elephants are pink. And it, I mean, just you some wild theory. And a question, can we argue with each other about what's over there? No, and we can speculate, right? I think your theory's wrong. You think my theory's wrong. We can speculate, but we can't argue because none of us have ever been outside of the room. All right, well, let's say that into this room, all of a sudden, appears a being of light. You know, kind of floats down and says, I'm from the other side of the wall. And he begins to tell you, not only am I from it, I created it. And he begins to tell you what's on the other side of the wall. Trick question, okay? Carefully nuanced question. Can you disagree and argue with him about what he's saying? No, right? Because in order to argue, you've got to have facts and experience of your own, of which you have none, right? Do you have to believe him? No. You can just say, I think you're a phony. I think you're a fraud. But if you decide that he is who he says he is, then you can believe what he says about the other side of the wall because he has the vantage point to be able to describe it to you. That is what the question of faith is. The question of faith is not, do I agree with everything that Jesus says? The question of faith is, do I think Jesus is who he says he is? Because if he is who he says he is, then I can trust what he says about what I cannot see. And that is what faith is. Faith is not a blind leap into the dark. Faith is accepting what you cannot understand and verify based on what you can understand and verify. And that is that Jesus is who he says he is and that he is raised from the dead. Right? I have confidence mostly in Jesus because I have seen enough evidence that I believe, I bet my whole soul on the fact that Jesus is who he says he is. You've got something, regardless of your religious disposition. You have something that you are trusting in also. You may not realize it, but everybody, as I demonstrated to you, everybody's got faith in something. You may have faith in science to tell us everything. And by the way, it tells us a lot, but there are some areas that science just can't speak into. And if you trust it to give you truth about something that it's not designed to give you truth about, you're going to be disappointed. Everybody has faith. You just have to make sure yours is in the right place. You make sense? All right, so you're running. This may sound weird. Let's say you're running from a bear, okay? And a bear's coming after you. He's bearing down on you, you know? And so you're running from him because this happens a lot in Raleigh-Durham, all right? And so you're running from the bear, and you come up to the edge of a cliff. Bear behind you, cliff below you, you know, certain depth in front. But you notice that there's a tree branch growing out from the side of the mountain on the cliff. And you notice that there are three branches. and you got to jump off the cliff and grab hold of one of these branches. Right? And so you jump and you just choose one of the three. Right now, two of them are rotten and one of them actually will hold you. You don't know which is which. Does it matter? Does it matter how confidently you jumped? No. Does it matter how sure you were of your branch? No. The only thing that matters is, did you grab the right branch? Right? The question of faith is not, do you have faith? Everybody's got faith. Everybody's hanging on to something. It's, is the thing that you have your faith in, is it secure enough to hold you and secure enough to take care of you? You see, I would just say to you very humbly that I respect and love science. I think, as I'm going to show you here in a minute, Christians make the best scientists. But I believe with all of my heart that Jesus Christ is the most reliable source of life and eternity for the 9 reasons that I gave you. And ultimately, at the end of the day, that's where most of my confidence in, because I believe he has earned it. All right, so you're like, well, what do you do with your doubts then? When you doubt, when you're in the class and you doubt. Let me give you a few things here, okay? We'll move through them quickly here. You got to doubt your doubts and put confidence in Jesus. Doubt your doubts and put confidence in Jesus. That is, if you think he deserves it. And here's what I mean by that. Here's your second point. Temporarily suspend judgment about the issue, realizing that when you finally understand both scripture and scientific evidence correctly, both of them are going to say the same thing. Right? Ultimately, when you get full understanding, they're going to say the same thing. Maybe you'll find out that your understanding of science will be wrong. Because you know that what is accepted as absolute fact today is often discarded tomorrow in scientific communities as absolute rubbish. A humble scientist will always acknowledge this. We look back at the science of 100 years ago and we think those people were crazy. Right? Do you really feel like in 100 years they're going to look back on us and say, man, those people had everything figured out? No, your great-grandchildren are going to look at you like you're an imbecile. How could they have possibly believed that? One of my favorite books in my library on this, written by a Christian, a guy named Thomas Kuhn, wrote the book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And he explained that science, its greatest achievements, are never done incrementally. They're always done in what he calls paradigm, huge shifts in the mentality. Everybody's working on a theory, and then somebody else comes along and says, that whole theory's wrong. And it's like the Copernican Revolution, they change it overnight. You know, you say, well, that was 200-some years ago with the Copernican Revolution, or however many years, I'm not really sure, I'm not a historian. Like quantum physics has happened in the last 20, 30 years. The whole paradigm that we were working on is wrong, right? Every 2 or 3 generations looks back at the ones before it and says, how could they have believed that? You're like, well, I'm sure science will eventually figure it out. That's faith. All right, you see? I love what Robert Jastrow, the astrophysicist, said in the New York Times, and I quote, my fear, okay, he's not a believer. My fear is that for the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. This is in the New York Times. I know you don't believe it, but it is. He is about to conquer the highest peaks, and as he pulls himself over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries. How you doing, man? That's going to be me, all right? So when you encounter a problem in science, history, or psychology, keep pressing, keep trusting. Dawkins says in The God Delusion, one of the truly bad effects of religion is that it teaches us that it is a virtue to be satisfied with not understanding. That's not true. Francis Bacon, all right, he said that God wrote two books, the book of nature, the book of scripture. He said when you understand both of them correctly, they're going to say the same thing. So keep pressing on both books because in the end, he says, you'll find they say the same things. By the way, this is going to be been nervous about this part. Part of this means that you and I ought to be open to certain things about our understanding of the Bible being revised. And let me return to this creation evolution question that I always get asked. All right, now hear me out, okay? You understand exactly what I'm saying in these next few moments here. One of my favorite conservative Bible scholars, John Selhammer, who taught right over at Southeastern Seminary, says that Genesis 1 and 2 mainly, its main purpose is to give theological poetry arranged in such a way to correspond with the Exodus and with the temple to show that in those things, God was recreating the new creation. Okay? You're like, well, what do you mean by that? He says, I'm not answering the question of whether or not Genesis 1 and 2 are literal. I'm just saying their main purpose is to give you a picture of what God was going to do in the Exodus and in the establishing of the temple. And what he is implying is Genesis 1 and 2 may not necessarily be describing actual specifics about creation. And some, even conservative Bible scholars, say that they could very easily accommodate everything that evolution tells us. Now, are they right in saying that? You know, and by the way, I'm not even saying John Selhammer believes in evolution. I'm just saying that that's what they're saying about Genesis 1 and 2. Are they right? Or are the intelligent design people and some theologians right when they tell us that if you're going to take it literally, that, you know, you can't read it that way and that the evidence does not really support evolution? That's a fascinating question. And Bible theologians and scientists both need to work on answering it. But what I'm telling you is that it doesn't necessarily need to be a question that determines your faith. Okay? What I'm telling you is this. If your question is, what about evolution? Don't let that trouble you. The real question of faith is not, how did God do it? But is there a God behind creation, however he did it? And was that God revealed in Jesus Christ? You see, Hebrews 11:3 says it like this. By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God. It doesn't say by faith we understand exactly how he did it. It just says by faith we understand that God was behind it. That's the question of faith. You see, it's not the question of the nuances of how he did it or how to interpret Genesis 1 and 2 or how to read the fossil chart. Right? Richard Dawkins actually says this himself in The God Delusion. I love this. He said, the quarrel is not between evolution and creation, but between naturalism and supernaturalism. Right? Richard Dawkins and the Bible agree. They have to be right. Right? I mean, when those two guys agree, that's the real question. Is there evidence of the supernatural? Now, here's your question if you're looking for it. Do you believe that the universe gives off evidence of a supernatural being behind it? And was that the God revealed in Jesus Christ? That's your question you need to ask. Christianity is not the enemy of science. In fact, as I mentioned a moment ago, I would suggest to you that Christians make the best scientists. Let me tell you why. I got a really good thing here. Don't take my word for it. Arguably, the best scientist alive right now is a guy named Francis Collins. He is the head of the Human Genome Project that just completed the monumental task of mapping the human DNA. He is also a very committed Christian. If you read Newsweek, this had a huge thing in there on a few months ago. This week, I had a chance to actually interview him. You're like, how? We graduated from UNC, so he's got some sympathy to our church because we have some UNC students here. And a guy on our staff knows a guy who works for him. Okay, so I got a chance to do a Skype interview with him. Now, it is Skype, so it's a little part of it may be hard to understand. The quality's not that great, but I want to let him answer a couple questions for you. So take a look right here on the screen, wherever you're watching from.
So science is a very powerful way to understand the natural world. That's what science is designed to do, and it's very successful at that. And a number of discoveries, particularly these days in biology, that are coming out of the scientific approach are really dizzying in their scope, and I think can be considered generally reliable. But science is completely unable to address things that fall outside of the natural realm of things. So, for instance, it would be a complete category error to take the tools of science and try to decide whether God exists. God being outside of nature is not really a subject to scientific investigation. Similarly, the resurrection as a miracle that I believe in passionately as a believer in Jesus Christ is not a subject that science is able to say much about because that would be a suspension of the natural laws. But one can certainly say if there is a God, and I believe there is, and if God is the author of those natural laws, then there's no reason God can't suspend them at moments of great import of the message to his people. Well, let's go back a few centuries. We would not have, I think, the success of science were it not for the Christian view that the universe created by God is an orderly universe and therefore has the kind of principles behind it that we, with our puny minds, might be able to discover and have done so. And when you look at many of the great discoveries happening about how physics and chemistry work, they were made by Christians who had this confidence that what they were doing was uncovering a little glimpse of God's mind, and in the process being able not only to be excited as human beings, but also to be worshiping God Almighty. That's how I view science. It's a chance to discover what God has done and also to worship him. But along the way, a lot of that sort of general focus by Christians has gotten lost. And it is unfortunate now that I think many Christian young people see science as perhaps not a friendly place for them to go. And so increasingly, over the last 100 years or so, science has been populated more and more by secular views. And the idea that Christians would find this as a place to carry out their life's work is a harder one for a lot of young people to see. And that's a terrible tragedy.
All right, so do Christians make good scientists? Well, I would just suggest to you, for the reasons that he gave you, Christians make the best scientists, because the fact that physics have laws is something that led to the greatest scientific discovery, and those laws were birthed in the idea that there was a God who established the laws of the universe. In fact, if you got 5 more minutes left in here, hang on. This article I was reading in the Wall Street Journal 2 weeks ago did a study on what kinds of people are most prone to believe in what they call paranormal activity. You know, paranormal stuff like Bigfoot, you know, goblins, Loch Ness Monster, sadomasochist dolls named Chucky. That's what I mean, you know. These are the kind of people that watch the M. Night Shyamalan movies and feel like they're historical documentaries. Those kind of people, okay? Listen to this. This study showed that people who believed in God in our country were 3 times less likely to believe in that stuff than people who were agnostics and atheists. In fact, the group that was least likely to embrace weird paranormal beliefs, born-again Christian college students. Any guys out there? You were the least likely to get sucked into all this kind of superstition stuff. In fact, my favorite part of the article, Bill Maher. You know, fair-minded Bill Maher coming out with a new movie, Religulous, who is, you know, he's one of the worst out there, this article said, for superstitions. He told David Letterman to stop taking his heart pills that the doctor had prescribed for him because Bill Maher said Western medicine doesn't work. He also, Bill Maher, doesn't believe in vaccination or Louis Pasteur's germ theory. He told Larry King on CNN that he won't take aspirin because he believes it's lethal and doesn't believe we've really found a vaccine for polio. You know, idiot. And I say that in Christian love, but it's just, I mean, here's a guy who has built his whole career on saying that Christianity is the enemy of science. But when you really get down to it, Christians made the best scientists because of their belief in how God ordered the world. And they also are the ones least likely to get sucked into paranormal stuff. Here's your last point. Back to the passage real quick. So let's end with this. The Apostle John in our passage gives you one great clue about how to avoid doubt. And it's extremely important. Verse 30. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you might have life in his name. How do you end up growing in your faith? Listen, you learn more about the gospel. Get into the Bible. What you'll find, I believe, if you are a skeptic, you're going to find what I have found, is that learning more about Jesus has opened up my own heart, my own knowledge of myself and life in a way that nothing else was able to. I feel somewhat like, you know, when you see a master musician take an instrument, and the way that musician plays that instrument, you know that that instrument was made for that type of musician, that type of skill. That's what I've discovered with Jesus Christ, how his love has radically transformed my life, how, you know, his acceptance has brought meaning and fulfillment, how he satisfies me. You know, I say this, and I don't say it tongue-in-cheek. I mean it with every fiber of my being. If I had 10,000 lives to live, I would give every single one of them to Jesus Christ simply because of the joy and the meaning that he has filled my life with. And what I implore you to do, if you are a skeptic, if you are listening to this, whether it's podcast, one of our campuses, or in whatever audience, search for Jesus. Search for him with all your heart, because I believe as you do, you'll find that he is searching for you. All right, so just don't take my word for it. Get into the Bible. The best way, as Martin Luther says, to defend the Bible is not to defend it. You defend it like a cage. You would defend a caged lion. Don't stand outside when somebody's insulting the caged lion, you know, insulting it. Just open the cage. I just want to open the cage for you and let you begin to search for Jesus. All right, if you are here and you're in a science degree, man, go after it. Show the glory of God in that. In fact, I don't want you to take my word for that. Listen to Francis Collins really quickly one more time. Roll this.
So let me say a word to particularly young people at Summit Church. This is a wonderful time to be involved in science. So many opportunities that we could only have dreamed of a few decades ago are now becoming possible, particularly in biology. This is going to be the century of biology and medicine. And we need people to come into that field with lots of energy and an adventuresome spirit and a dedication to serve humanity and a sense of ethics to be sure that we take these discoveries and apply them in a way that provides maximum benefit to as many people as possible. I think we particularly need people of faith to come into this environment and pursue their life's work in science. There's many ways that that can be beneficial to serving, and I think that's what we are all called to do. And so if somebody listening to this has that interest and is worried that somehow science is going to cause you to lose your faith because you'll be converted into this secularist, atheistic view, don't worry. For me, who was once an atheist and became a believer in my 20s and have now lived in this scientific environment for 3 decades, it only strengthens my faith to be able to work in a scientific arena and see the wonders of God's creation. And that is a privilege and a pleasure and an opportunity of worship every day.
Let me get you, if you would, just to bow your heads. Let me pray over you. I just want to say to the two groups that are here, listening, even if you're listening just to the podcast, I invite you to say a prayer to Jesus if you don't believe. Jesus, if you're real, I want to know you. Say it to him right now. If you're real, I don't know if you are, but if you're real, I want to know you. If that's you, I want to invite you also to let us know that so that we can put the resources in your hands to help you with that discovery. We'd be willing to talk to you. I would personally be willing to talk to you. I'd also love for you to commit to come the next 4 weeks here to our church as we give you the steps on how you become a follower of Jesus. If you're here and you struggle with doubt, maybe you should say something to Jesus like this. Jesus, I don't know all the mysteries, but I believe in you. I believe that you died for me, and that is the one thing I'm going to hold on to. That's my cornerstone.